turn the left and the right wings can ask during my talk. But it's a lively talk, I hope. Okay, so Franck said that when a constant curvature, when the curvature is constant, jumps the boundary, this is old stuff, finite dimensional, everything is known. My goal is to try to convince you that this is not old stuff, that almost nothing is known from the probabilistic and the, also the geometric point of view. All right, so there are three words in the title, random hyperbolic surfaces. Let me try to introduce first hyperbolic surface. So what do I mean by surface? I always mean a 2D manifold, which is orientable, so no Möbius strip in this talk. And hyperbolic surface, they have many, many definitions. That's why they are connected to many areas of mathematics. So here are a couple of definitions. I won't go through all of those definitions. Even if you don't know what a hyperbolic surface is, I will give you a hands-on definition in what follows. But they are, let's say, metric definition as constant curvature Riemannian manifold or model dependent, meaning that you have a manifold and you have an atlas of charts where coordinate changes are isometry of the hyperbolic plane that is represented by H2. There is a purely algebraic definition of hyperbolic surface as quotient of PSL2 by some nice groups. There is also a uniformization point of view because hyperbolic surface in each conformal class, you can find one representative which is only one representative which is a hyperbolic surface, and so on. But I will focus on this hands-on definition where hyperbolic surface will be obtained by gluing elementary pieces, either a pair of pens or ideal triangles. Okay, so let's do that. Quick recap 101, course 101 on a hyperbolic plane. So here I represent the hyperbolic plane with the disk. The metric is displayed, and I remind you that geodesics are arcs in this model, which are orthogonal to the boundary. The boundary at infinity is just a circle. And so that's the plane, topology of the plane. And if you are looking at the topology of a disk with three holes, it's called a pair of pens. And this time, right? Well, sorry for that. I will go to the left more than to the right. So a pair of pens is this disk with three holes. And there is a unique metric that you can put on this pair of pens if you specify the boundary length. So if the boundaries are forced to be geodesic boundaries of length A, B, and C, then there is a unique structure, hyperbolic structure in there that gives you this length A, B, and C for the length of the beds, if you wish. Notice that one of these, or even the three numbers, can be zero. And when it's zero, it's called a puncture, and it will be at an infinite distance. So this guy is non-compact if one of these three numbers is equal to zero. It's a puncture. Okay? And so once I told you that those pieces exist and are unique for each triplet of a number, then you can try to pass them together to build a hyperbolic surface. How do you do that? Well, it's easy. Oops. You can imagine that you take those pair of pens and you glue them along their boundaries. Of course, boundaries lengths have to match if you want to glue. So this has to be, sorry, that's me. Let's do that here. So this has to be equal to this if you want to glue them together. And you glue them along the combinatorics of a graph, and the combinatorics of this graph will also fix for you the topology. Here, the topology is you've got genus three because you've got three holes, and there are two boundaries, one here and one there. Okay, so it's purely combinatorial. I fixed for you just the boundary length, and there is also an additional parameter, which is the amount of twist you perform before gluing the surface, the pair of pens together. So the nice thing is that if you fix such a combinatorial decomposition, so-called a pair of pens decomposition, then by varying all those numbers, the length and the twist, you can get all hyperbolic surface with this topological type.
It's a constant curvature.
Sorry, constant curvature minus one. Yes. So as Frank said, it's really a finite dimensional stuff. So, end of the story. You can get all hyperbolic surface by gluing those pair of pants together with the prescribed length and the twist. But the end, but also the beginning, because I told you you can, but there is actually many ways you can obtain the same hyperbolic surface by gluing pair of pants. There are many pair of pants gluing that gives the same hyperbolic surface. So it's an over-parametrization. That's the big problem, because if you want to understand the geometry of those surfaces, you want to somehow to get a canonical way of prescribing your surface. And this identification are nasty. Okay, but still we can denote by this letter MG L1 up to LN. That's the moduli space. It's the space of all genus G, so G the genus, hyperbolic surface with geodesic boundaries. So the boundaries are the thing you see at the exterior of length L1 to LN, geodesic boundaries. And again, when one of these LI is equal to zero, it's just a puncture. Okay, so that's this guy is a finite dimensional space, if you wish. And we want to understand it. So the little count tells you that if you fix the genus and if you fix the number of boundaries, the number of parameters you need to specify the space is 6g minus 6 plus 2n. And you need 2g plus n minus 2 pair of pants. And we will focus more specifically on two moduli space. So the one that I denote by mg, which is the moduli space of genus g, no boundaries, but the genus will be larger than two hyperbolic surface. And m0n, so now the genus is zero, it's a planar surface, but I have n punctures. So 0, 0, 0, 0, n times, and n must be bigger than 3. Okay, so I focus on those two extremes, high genus, mg, g will be large, and m0n, zero is fixed, the genus is zero, but the number of punctures goes to infinity. Questions so far? Zero, zero. If you want to go back to your nap, here is a take-home message. The take-home message, roughly speaking, is that this space, smaller space, is morally speaking a compact manifold of finite dimension, and it's morally the same as the space of trivalent map with 2g minus 2 nodes. So trivalent map is just you start with 2g minus 2 nodes, which have three legs, and you pair them uniformly at random. Uniformly. There is no randomness yet. That's a big space. You can enumerate how many maps there are there. And there's a lot of beautiful theorem in the combinatorics and probabilistic literature on those guys, Bolobash, Erdős, Shannon, and so on and so on and so on. And what we're trying to do now is to take all those beautiful theorem and to import them in the hyperbolic setup. It's the same spirit for the low genus many puncture. This is still also a compact manifold of finite dimension, which should be thought of as the space of trivalent planar maps, now planar, with n nodes roughly. And there are also lots of beautiful results that we want to import to the hyperbolic setup. Okay? Everybody tapping? Yes! You specify yourself left or right? So the middle is this line. I put right. Okay. Question.
I thought the M0N would you obtain by gluing the pants along the tree
Yes,
allowing planar
it's true. It will be, you will have picture of that. It's gluing along a tree. So the trivalent map behind the gluing of pair of pants is a tree. Yes, you competition has started. As so. Did you hear the question? Basically, for this guy, you need to glue a pair of pens along a tree structure.
So it's not the
If you do pair of pens, but if you glue ideal triangle, not equilateral, then it would be a mass that is behind, not a tree. Yes.
You're going to tell us about the cases of
No, but let me count this. Just to make the competition more interesting.
Can we get one more point?
If you have a good question.
That was
That works for me once. Huh? Okay. So first thing that you want to understand is no probability, just purely deterministic question. You fix an observed level, a geometric quantity called phi, and you want to understand what are the values that phi can take over the moduli space. Okay, so fix phi and try to understand, for example, extrema property, what are the lowest possible value for a genuine G hyperbolic surface phi can take, or the largest possible value, purely deterministic. Then there are random questions. Now you want to understand the behavior of this observable for a random surface SG if SG is fit at random in your space. But for this, you need to specify the measure, the probability measure that you will use. So there are many choices a priori. Okay, so let's start first with this deterministic and extremal property. So the beside this, they give you a list of some observables that you can look at. The first one that comes to mind is the diameter. So if your surface is compact, the diameter is the maximal distance between any two points. Of course, if you have a cusp, then it's infinite. One which is really important for hyperbolic geometry is the systole. It's the length of the smallest non-trivial loop here. You also have an injectivity radius. So if you have a point on your surface, it's the largest ball that you can put around this point. That is exactly the same as in a hyperbolic plane. Building upon the systole, you may also want to ask about all the possible lengths of all loops, not only the smallest one. So it's called the length spectrum. I will come back to that. The Cheeger constant also, which measures the expansion property of your surface, is of high interest. The total pans length. So this is the smallest length of curve you need to cut your surface to produce pair of pans. So it's the minimum of all pan decomposition of the length sum of the all curves. And there is the spectral gap. So the spectral gap is the first non-trivial eigenvalue for the Laplacian spectrum on your surface. How to display that? So this is my heuristic representation of the spectral gap. All right, so there are many geometric and spectral observables that you can look at. And just to tell you, this is still active research. Let's look at what we can say about those quantities. Again, this is purely deterministic. So what about the diameter? The diameter, you've got trivial bounds. The diameter must be at least log G, for example, but must be finite. The systole, it's easy to construct examples where the systole is arbitrarily small when the genus is large. But the systole is less than 2 log G. It's a bit the same argument as this one. The Cheeger constant, also here you've got trivial bounds. You can construct surface with small Cheeger constant. But the fact that there are a surface with Cheeger constant bounded away from zero when G goes to infinity, this is highly non-trivial. It's the construction of expanded surfaces. So go back to Margulis and so on. So this the fact that this guy is strictly positive, it's already non-trivial. The same for spectral gap. The Cheeger constant, by the way, is always less than one by comparing to the hyperbolic plane. Spectral gap is less than 1/4 by comparing to the universal cover as well, and so on and so forth. Yes?
Is that the same 1/4 that all the stars are circular?
No, no. So that's like a physical divide. But still, it's a question. You're lagging, guys. Okay, so this was morally the state of the art in the 80s. And now, just for the systole, the best bound up to now is still due to Fuser and Tarnak, 1994. It's larger than 3/4, and it's not known whether this is the good bound or the 2 log G. It's between 3/4, 4/3 only, 4/3 and 2 log G. The total has been improved a little bit from the trivial bounds by Goodmarier Young to G to the 7/6. We recently proved with Thomas Butaski and Bram Petri that actually the diameter, the lower bound, is the good answer asymptotically. It's log G. And it's quite recent, 2019. So here, This was a breakthrough by Hyde and Mighty a couple of years ago that construct hyperbolic surface whose spectral gap matches the asymptotically the upper bound, 1/4, and I'll come back to that in a minute. And we proved 2 years ago or 1 year ago with my same friends, Thomas and Bram, that the Cheeger constant actually is less than 2/π. 2/π is it's not the correct answer. I mean, prove the upper bound, but what's nice is it's not the upper bound. So it's strictly less than what it is in the hyperbolic plane. So you see, this is still active, and we don't have yet the full answer for many canonical observables, geometric observables for hyperbolic surface. Questions? So although that seem very deterministic statement, that they are deterministic theorem, in all of these proofs, maybe not this one, but all the rest, randomness is involved by randomness is used to construct examples here of minimizing diameter of here also for the Cheeger constant expanders. Also, these examples are produced by taking random hyperbolic surface and so on. So even though these are deterministic results, the core of the proof uses randomness. So now, randomness, if you want to sample a hyperbolic surface at random, I have to tell you which measure do I use. So there are many combinatorial definition of construction of random surface of hyperbolic surface. Hence, there are a lot of discrete measure that you can build using those decomposition. For example, I told you about the pan decomposition. You can just imagine that you put your length at random or the trivalent graph beneath the construction at random, and then this will produce for you a random hyperbolic surface. Yes, you really want to win the challenge.
So in the case of these graphs instead of surfaces, that, so there was the expander, there was a very difficult construction that was needed was
Yes, but before
created.
that, before that, actually, the first construction of expanders goes back to Kolmogorov, and it was random.
So in the surfaces, there is a random construction, but is there also a more difficult deterministic one?
Yeah, so those Lubotsky-Phillips-Sarnack construction, they are deterministic, but they are more complicated to explain than the random construction, at least to me. Yes, sir. You're taking the lead. Okay, so these are a lot of discrete measure, I would say, which are used in the previous theorem I told you to prove deterministic results of the extremal property. But the measure I will focus on now is this measure that most people here know very well. It's the Weil-Petersen measure on the moduli space. It could be thought of as the Lebesgue measure on this space. Why is it so? So there are many ways to say it's a Lebesgue measure. Probably the safest for me is using pan decomposition. So I told you that if you fix this combinatorial decomposition into pair of pans, if I vary the length here and the twist and put them as real parameters, then this arrow is surjective. By varying those 6z minus 6 parameters, I can get any hyperbolic surface. So what I can do is I can take Lebesgue measure here and take the push forward. Of course, I mod out by identifying two guys if they are the same hyperbolic surface. And turns out, non-trivial fact, that after those identification, if I mod out by mapping class group, then I get a finite measure down here on the moduli space, which is the Weil-Petersen measure. And so it is the push forward of the Lebesgue measure after modding out by this construction for any pan decomposition. Good. So probably you all heard about the breakthrough of Myriad Mirzakhani, who was probably the first to study those surface from a probabilistic point of view. And the key ingredient for the random statements that will come are estimates on the volumes. So what do I mean by volumes? I mean, you just, dB is a measure, right? And so you just want to understand the volume, the measure of this space, the genus G with n punctures. called them VGM. And it turns out that this, so Iriam means I can produce new recursion for this volume who enables her and the graph to, for example, get those type of asymptotes. Those asymptotes are for N0 fixed and the genus goes to infinity. And these are the fundamental brick or the fundamental ingredients in the coming theorem. From those new equations, she was able to get a new proof of Witten's conjecture, but more important for us here, she gave the first indication that this random Bell-Peterson surface, so what do I mean by random Bell-Peterson? I sampled in NG according to the Bell-Peterson measure, nonetheless. So typically, a guy like that will have a Giga constant which is strictly positive. When with high probability, when G goes to infinity, we'll have a spectral gap, so there will be expanders, but the diameter will be less than 40 log G. It's just a bound. We don't know whether it's 2 log G, 1 log G, or even if there is a low flash number, low flash number, we don't know. And so, this and so on. Okay, so this was breakthrough from 2007 to 2013. But as a take-home message, let me give you a glimpse of what we are doing with Timothy Budd, Dolman Inzaski, and Bram Petrie. It's somehow reinterpreting those famous recursion of Mirzakhani into the realm of this peeling exploration of random surface. Don't worry, what I'm going to say here is purely deterministic. My reinterpretation will just be the fact that. So this T is nothing but R to the 6G minus 6, the Teichner space. This is just a pair of bands. And I told you there are many, many ways of gluing pair of bands to get the same harmonic surface. And so what I will produce for you, building on Mirzakhani insight, is to make a section making a canonical representative. If I give you a hyperbolic surface, I will give for you one, only one, pan decomposition of that surface, a canonical one. So this canonical pan decomposition can be obtained as follows. Here is your surface that you don't know. You want to encode it, bond it to your best friend. So for that, you will have in your pocket an algorithm. An algorithm is just here a function, and this function will tell you, given this boundary, I want to start. This is an ant, a little ant. I want to start a little ant at that point. Sure. And this little ant will enter my surface orthogonally to this boundary at that point. Okay? And this ant will, like an ant, produce a little bit of pheromone, you know? And when she crosses her past path or a boundary, she will notice it. Okay? So she gets into the surface until it crosses its past path at this point. Then I claim that at this point, if the ant has noticed something here, its path or the boundary, then it must have discovered some new topology. What do I mean by new topology? I mean that what you see here, the union of the blue curve and of the white curve, is topologically a pair of bands. Indeed, imagine that you put springs. This is a little spring around here and another spring around there. Those springs, they are not geodesic, but now you wiggle them a little bit, they will contract until they find their geodesic representative. The claim is that when they do so, those springs will define a pair of ants in which the ant was in. The ant has not exited this pair of ants. Okay, so that's a purely local way of exploring my surface by an ant and discovering one pair of paths. Then you cut at those points, at those belts here, and you've got a new surface. Yes. You can get lost in, but with very, very, very probability zero. It's generic. So what I'm saying is not a section, it's a generic section with probability one. You should say, oh, but it's probability one, you need the Bell-Peterson measure. No. It's generic for anything that would have it's generic. Yes.
You think the shortest blue curve or
No, the ant is just a geodesic that has been shot orthogonally to the boundary. Okay. Sorry.
Sure.
That's my algorithm that did that. My algorithm is a function. So actually, when you start with the circuit, there is a mark point. And your algorithm tells you, if you see a mark point, then you start 2 meters on the right of this mark point. That's your algorithm. It's a function that you have in your algorithm. Purely deterministic. Then you go on with what's remaining. So again, you look in your pocket. In your pocket, you see, oh, if my surface is made of two holes of that length, blah, 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 then I want to start from this point. It's in your function. Then you shoot your new ant at that point. Do the same thing. She will go off the boundary until it hits either the boundary or its path. It defines a pair of pants in which the ant was in. You cut. And you go on. Your algorithm tells you, now I want to shoot my ant from this point up, new pair of pants. And this drawing took me 1 hour. This one. This is a pair of pants. You cut. So I let you 20 seconds to see what is going on. So you imagine that you put a little spring here and a spring around there, here. Shh. They will find their geodesic representative and you cut. Okay, everybody got it? Do we agree? And so on and so forth. So, in this way, I have decomposed my surface into a pair of pan decomposition. Only using my algorithm, and this algorithm was purely local and based only on the geometry of the surface, not its Teichenberg representative. It's really something that is defined on moduli space. It's was I was just using the isometric class of the surface. Okay, but what is important in this special decomposition is that those pans. They are special. It's not any pant. It's a pant in which, if I start this ant, then I know that the ant will exit, cross its path, or exit the boundary inside this pant. That's very special property. For example, here, if I start the ant here, then she cannot do that. Because by definition, the pant was defined. By the first crossing of the end of its path or the boundaries. Okay? That's a very special property. So that's the deterministic block in Mirzakhan execution. And from that, now if you put probability in it, the Van-Peterson measure, then the fact that those pans are special is the so-called Machen identity. And then this decomposition will immediately give you the Mirzakhan execution. But you can take this as a deterministic way of encoding your surface. Yes. Don't play anymore. Stop. Yes.
So I see the length of the cast, but where are the twists for the
Yeah, the twist it's here. You have to remember this information that this green part is glued to this one. So the twist here is the value between 0 and 2 pi, let's say, because I don't need more than 2 pi. Go back. The twist here is okay. Let's go back here. Maybe those 2 points I tell you I need to glue this one to this one. And when I discovered this, I have this point, and I tell you, ah, but this point is the same as this one, and this will encode this will encode the twist.
I thought the only data you need to run the algorithm is deterministic is the initial green point. How do you read
Yeah, that's the initial green point, but then when you once you discover that from okay, cut out your surface, this is not relevant, but the ant or the family of ants here, she knows they know this point and they know this point. And then and the fact that you get here, you have an additional identification, this point must be the same as this one. And this will encode somehow your twist. Okay, yes? Ah.
Are you asserting that with this decomposition for each band, there is no uncompatible?
Yeah, so this was the question that has been based already here that there is very tiny probability event that your ant is doing something like this, but that's a zero probability event actually. So if your surface is generic, if you have fixed your algorithm in your pocket, if your surface is generic, you will never encounter this. Your ant will always, with probability one, always cross this path or come back to a new boundary. Yes.
There's something I'm missing, which is how do you keep your, if you have a set of three boundary points, what's your algorithm telling you about where to start?
It tells you if you have three boundary points, one, two, three
components, but they don't have points on them.
Yeah.
Where do you
they do. They do. Yeah. Yeah. Let's say you have one boundary here. Also, you have one point at the beginning.
That's a mark.
Yes,
it's not better.
Yes. Okay. Any other question from that side? Good. So that's the deterministic algorithm underlying the Mirzakhanis Rekursh. Once you have these numbers, those very Petersen volumes, then you can do a lot of probability. And very recently, so I summarized this in one slide, but there has been a lot of work on the spectral gap by Anand Taraman, Nalini Anand Taraman, and also those competitive, those other teams. And they managed now to show this nearly Riemannian phenomenon that a typical Bell-Peterson surface SG will have a spectral gap which is almost maximal, 1^-ε, with very high probability. All of those works are based, of course, on the Selberg-Tres formula, and you need to put in this formula. So if you don't know, it relates spectral information to length of curves. So to have some control on the length of closed geodesics, you need to understand those numbers, the volume of moduli space with genus G and say boundary of length L1 and L2. So it's an ingredient in their proof. Okay? So by now we know that a Weyl-Peterson surface is nearly Riemannian, nearly the optimal spectral gap. So that was for the spectral spectrum. Now the length spectrum. So what is the length spectrum? If you have a surface, hyperbolic surface here, I can draw all possible closed curves on this one and take their geodesic representative. So you have a curve like that, you have one like that, and so on. There is only a discrete set of those guys, and you can measure their length. And actually, their length will never, so the red one here is probably the shortest here. The orange is the length of this one, which you see go around, below, and come back. You also, you may do several turns also, that's a green one, and so on. So imagine all possible curves, topological type of curves on those surface, take their geodesic representative, take their length. This will give you a collection of numbers, positive numbers. Fact, they will not accumulate near zero. They will only accumulate towards infinity. And so that's a random collection of numbers. Why random? Because the surface itself is random. Then again, by putting in the machine those estimate on the Weyl-Peterson volumes, Mirzakhani and Petri were able to prove that this collection of numbers, when the genus goes to infinity, converges in distribution towards a Poisson point process with an explicit intensity, this Koch minus 1 over t. In particular, they get convergence in distribution of the systole because the systole is just the first of this point. And what's still kind of unknown or not understood is the universality of this Poisson point process, because it also pops up as the length spectrum of other random surface in high genus, like random trivalent unicellular maps, or the tight length spectrum of the Weyl-Peterson surface. Yes.
I understand. because if the genus is large, shouldn't you get all possible lengths and therefore the length spectrum will be made out zero?
No, because there is only one place where the system is small. The system actually converges towards a random number, but which is strictly positive. So you want
for
a
fixed genus, for a fixed genus, but
even if the genus tends to infinity, so for fixed G does not accumulate, but their theorem is for G equals to infinity. So you won't have a place where the system goes to zero. It is. But this comes from asymptotic estimates on Van Etterson volume with large G and a small one. That is surprising, but you can do the computation for random trivalent graph as well. So for random trivalent graph, you know that if you take a three-valent graph with many legs, you pair them at random, then it's possible that you won't see small cycles. It's possible. Or the smallest cycle converges in distribution. Same phenomenon. If I forget to count the points, please tell me. It's Rick against the right wing. Okay. So that was for high genus. Now let's move on to the genus zero planar case with punctures. So it's a hyperbolic surface sampled according to Van Peterson, genus zero and punctures. So as you said, it looks like a tree. So the pan decomposition, if you were to decompose this in pair of pans, you would get a tree. But there are other ways to decompose the ideal triangles, for example, and you would get more like a trivalent planar map heading there. So let's denote Sn with this dot, a Van Peterson surface with genus zero and punctures sampled uniformly. And this point zero is just a reference point picked uniformly in the surface according to its hyperbolic mesh. Then we proved last year with Timothy that we have two types of convergence of those surfaces. You can first sit on this reference point and let n go to infinity and look at what you see around you. This is a local convergence without renormalization, and this would converge towards an infinite hyperbolic surface, which is homomorphic to the plane minus discrete punctures. But it's random, something random in the limit with your simulation. But you can also see this Sn0 as somehow a compact. Actually, it's not compact because of the punctures, but you cut the punctures, then you would get a compact metric space. And if you renormalize all distances by n to the 1/4, then you get a convergence towards this universal Brownian sphere, which is the random fractal metric space that appears also as a scaling limit of planar maps model built in UV quantum gravity and so on. So let me give you aesthetic flavor of that. How much time do I have, Frederick? No, Frederick. 20.
Including questions.
Okay. Take your time. Okay, so we have this SN. And this is the Riemann representation of Sn. So what is this? So Sn is the hyperbolic surface, genus zero, and punctures. So it can be seen as a polygraph in a hyperbolic free space where the punctures are at the boundary. That's the theorem of Riemann. And there is a unique such representation so that what you see here in the 3D hyperbolic space is exactly the hyperbolic surface S. Okay, so this guy, if you sit at a random point here and send n to infinity, then you will converge as the number of punctures goes to infinity towards a random landscape of punctures. Then you're sitting inside and you see something around. Yes?
Two cells are the like the geodesic sphere.
Yes. These are half spheres, so they are geodesics. Although this picture is misleading because this is not what we prove. we cannot would be very happy to understand what is doing with this simulation with the repartition of points on the boundary. What we prove is the metric aspect of this. We have a metric space here. We sit at a point and we converge towards the random metric space that we see here. It's only metric, nothing. But this convergence tells actually a lot. It tells a lot about local statistics. For example, if you sit at a random point and look at a ball of radius 15 around you, how many punctures can you capture within this ball of radius 15? That's a random number. And as n goes to infinity, convergence towards the same random number defined here for this guy.
Hey.
Yes?
Good question. I missed on the previous slide. So you said that in the local topology, this is the plane minus countable set of points. Is it true that there is nothing specific about Z2?
No, I said homeomorphic. It's homeomorphic.
It's homeomorphic. Okay, so.
It is a hyperbolic surface with countably many punctures. Which is homomorphic to
so Z2 is just a
remark. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can take whatever you wish, any system.
It's
time to wake up. Yeah. Any other questions from that side? No? All right, and on the other side, so that was the Benjamin Isham local convergence point of view. On the other side, it's this scaling point of view, where now you see that as a metric space, and you rescale the metric by n to the 1/4, and you converge toward this Brownian sphere. So the Brownian sphere here, I took a very beautiful simulation. If you don't know what to do during my talk, just Google Stufler and look at his amazing simulations. They are turning beautifully. And this is also, again, nothing, our convergence has nothing to do with the embedding that you see here. It's just purely metric. And this metric space here is a compact, random compact metric space. Over the sphere, but has positive dimension 4, so really fractal. So what does this convergence tell you about this? It tells you about, for example, distance between k points. If you sample k points uniformly in there, k points, then the matrix of all distances is a random matrix. If you rescale by n to the 1/4, it will converge towards the same random matrix here that you would have between any k points sampled uniformly. You may say, for those specialists in the room, whoa, 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 how do you get a Gromov-Hausdorff convergence here? Because this object is non-compact. True. Look, it's written Gromov-Prokhorov, not Gromov-Hausdorff. So there are two ways to cope with this problem. Either you just cut, if you have a problem, you cut the problem. Either you cut the punctures, and it's possible to do this in a canonical way. And if you cut the punctures, then you are back to a compact thing. And there we have got a Gromov-Hausdorff convergence. But if you don't want to cut the punctures, this Gromov-Prokhorov captures what the measure is telling you. What's the measure? It's a hyperbolic measure, and there is very little mass around the cusp, around the punctures. So actually, they kind of disappear in the limit. You don't see that the object is non-compact in the limit. It's a compact object. Or if you wish, the measure here will accumulate on a compact kind of metric space. So what type of observable also you can put in this Gromov-Hausdorff or Gromov-Prokhorov convergence is length of separating curves. You want, say, a curve in your metric space that would separate your metric space into two pieces containing at least n of the 4 punctures on each side. Then you want to minimize over length of all those curves. This is an observable that you can put in this convergence. Okay, so what are the methods we use to prove this theorem? So in principle, this is accessible with the peeling method I described to you with this AND process and so on, which is easier in this genius zero business because there is no genius. It's just a tree. So in principle, this Benjamin-Isham convergence would follow from the peeling. The Gromov-Prokhorov here with the peeling, it's more complicated. And actually, we don't do peeling. We rely on digestion of those objects with label trees. This is something classical in random planar map theory, that you encode your random planar graph or map by simple objects which are label trees. It's this famous Schaeffer or Plutier Di Francesco Kitter bijection. And actually, what's funny is that those bijection, those encoding with label trees, they were discovered in this hyperbolic context before the discrete analog for planar maps. Nobody noticed, except Timothy, maybe. But this was done before by Penner and Bodich Epstein. So the actually, it did something more general, and a specification of this construction would give the encoding use. So the idea, rough idea, is the following. You have your hyperbolic surface here, down here, and you have a specific puncture in orange here. Now you will consider the cut locus. So the cut locus is something geometric. It's the set of all points on your surface from which you can start two different geodesics towards this puncture. Of course, this puncture is at infinity, but you can make sense of a geodesic towards this puncture. And two different geodesics having the same length. Again, the length is infinite, but you can make sense of that. So it makes sense, right? If you start from here, if you want to go to this puncture, let's say there is only one way, you go down. If you're on the other side of your surface, you go down the other side, but there is like a path where you could, you know, go other two different ways to this puncture. And there are those special points where it's a branching of order three, where you've got three different possible ways to go to this puncture. So generically, the structure you see emerging here in red is an embedded three regular tree, plane tree. And if you decorate this tree with angles or lengths of geodesics, then this completely encodes your surface. If I give you this guy, then you have your surface. And now what you do is you take the Lebesgue measure, this Veit-Peterson measure on surface, you push it forward on this tree, and it turns out that what you see here is reasonably well-behaved. It's not far from being a uniform tree plus some labels, which evolve a bit like a random walk along the path. And then from this, you're back to safe business, where Grégory and Jean-François proved the convergence to the Brownian sphere, and you try to adapt the proofs. Adapting does not mean copy-paste, of course. Let me mention that those bijections have been extended to a much more general setting by Bunn and Sonnenfeld very recently, and I really recommend those, the reading of this paper. Okay, so that's all for today on the G is equal to zero, so the planar case. But that's not all. There are many perspectives. So we understood a piece of what is going on for the large genus. The low genus, now we kind of understand this Brownian sphere limit, but the universality phenomenon is not yet understood, because we have for this model, what if we tweak a little bit the model? For example, you have geodesic boundaries and so on. So there should be two universality classes, those of the Brownian sphere and many classes of the stable maps in low genus. Genus one already is not understood. From this perspective, we have not understood why the length spectrum is universal, and the Laplacian spectrum. I told you about this one quarter. This was a big achievement of many people, but it's only for the Veit-Peterson guy with large G, no punctures, and MG, high genus. We don't know what's the diameter of Veit-Peterson in large genus. We don't know what happens if we add punctures. Let's say, even if we add one puncture, do we have to redo the proof, or is it somehow resistant to adding one puncture? But what if the genus is proportional to the number of punctures? Will it change something? What about other measures? There are other natural measures, like Thurston measures, which is not at all the same as the Veit-Peterson measure. So this is all up. Thanks a lot. It's still time for the left party to make it up. Yes.
Well, maybe you said something that I missed. In this emergence to the Brownian sphere, I have an impression that you should also have a certain point process in this Brownian sphere, which is the image of the cusp structures. What is this? The ask about what's
happening to these cusps on the Brownian sphere. So basically, those cusps on the Brownian sphere, first you don't see them, let's cut them.
Yeah.
Okay, you cut them all aside. Then this point process on the Brownian sphere just gives the mass measure on the Brownian sphere.
So it's correct to say that I see the Brownian sphere and on top of that the Poisson point process was.
It's not the Poisson point process, it's as you were considering a planar triangulation,
sure.
And you asked what's for the vertices in planar triangulation.
Right. So it's actually highly correlated and not very, very.
Yeah, so you can consider that as a measure, it will give after normalization the mass measure of the point. Yes, Jelena.
Talking about this, but I think it's more like other functions were in G, and the argument is put in G, and then we set the gap. So, how do you solve it? And I think also, Joel on us, they're doing this on board. They seem to be able to do a small number of functions.
Leader of the genius?
Another. Is really the old square because square root g is the right one, but I think they seem to be able to at least when the small to the left.
You know much better than me. So Yilin said that for the spectral gap, so not the tracy window, but the spectral gap, this one quarter phenomenon should hold also when you add little o, let's say, of square root g punctures. But what if you had long boundaries? Did I count your, so the left is ahead?
You missed some right ones.
I missed? How many?
I wasn't counting, but you missed some.
Did I?
How many?
Two?
The left and the right.
Okay, so this is fine.
You can't distinguish your bolts at that level.
Any
other questions? Okay, so I think we can find a new client. Is that your drawing of your
university party?
But on top of
a picture,
not a picture, I think the big line, it's easy.